At the younger end of life, we have a mortgage. We have children to educate. There is a dependence upon the jobs that we do. Family finance is finance is required for family projects. And until a couple of months ago, everything was okay. We could look to tomorrow. We were aware, of course, that something might happen. And then it actually did. In a very sudden, a very unexpected way. And we feel now that we can't be sure of what lies ahead. We're aware, of course, that much of the world seems to be worse. If we think about the United States, the United Kingdom, the South American countries, some of those parts of the world seem to have abandoned the fight against the pandemic. There is hunger, medicines running out, spiraling death counts, and we're told this weekend that the pandemic is accelerating. Health systems overloaded. And it's all given rise to racial tensions that, of course, were there just under the surface. But now there is eruption. Anarchy seems to be taking a hold in some parts of the world. And of course, we're aware that brothers and sisters in these parts of the world are experiencing even more trying circumstances. And we ask the question, how long can we in New Zealand go on in isolation in a world that depends on interrelationships and trade? And it's all pointing to the last days and perhaps the last stint. And I want to think about that in relation to Israel and their life in the wilderness and the last stint before they went into the promised land. From the time Israel left their houses in Goshen, with their Passover blood-painted doorways, they lived in tents for the next 40 years. In Egypt, they'd seen the wonder of the 10 plagues, in which God had destroyed their enemy, but looked after them and enabled them to begin that wilderness journey. And from then on, they lived and moved under the Almighty's direction, with the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night to lead them. And this is what Moses said under God's direction. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. And from then they moved camp in the wilderness 50 times you can count in those 40 years. There was the Red Sea crossing, where they looked back and saw the Egyptians destroyed. The gift of quail and manna, water from the rock. And in Sinai, when they reached it, there was the covenant. And their acceptance by the Almighty into that covenant, the purification of them ceremony that took place at that time. And then 600,000 men plus women and children witnessed the giving of the Ten Commandments. All the people witnessed the thunder and the lightning, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain surrounded by smoke. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. "You speak to us, and we'll listen," they said to Moses. "Don't let God speak to us, we'll die." And they witnessed Moses repeatedly summoned up Mount Sinai. And on the eighth occasion, following the rebellion of the golden calf, when Moses interceded for their sin, he returned with his skin aglow, reflecting God's glory to the extent that they were blinded by looking at it. Then the tabernacle was made with all the sacrifices instituted, all set up within a year of them leaving Egypt. And during that whole time, neither their clothes nor their shoes wore out. But then in the 40th year, Moses was infuriated with their murmuring, despite all that they had seen, day by day. And in his fury, he struck the rock twice. Aaron's death followed. Eleazar, his son, succeeded. And it was from the 49th encampment near Pisgah when first the Ammonites with their king Sihon and then Og, king of Bashan, was defeated one after the other. And so it was in a spirit of victory, brothers and sisters, that they set up the 50th camp, the last camp, in the plains of Moab. Near the Jordan, across from Jericho, now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Moab was terrified of the people because they were numerous. They dreaded the Israelites. So the Moabites said to the elders of Midian, "This horde will devour everything around us like an ox eats up the green plants in the field." We know how they hired Balaam, a seer, astrologer from Babylonia. The first messengers that Balak sent to Balaam were sent packing. He sent more of high rank with greater rewards. And when Balaam eventually started off on a journey, Numbers 22, verse 22 says, God was incensed that Balaam was going. And the angel of the Lord took his stand on the path to oppose him. How God looked after his people. And on arrival, from different vantage points, Balaam was shown the camp below. The very camp that terrified the Moabites. They looked down on an ordered camp, with the white tents and the tabernacle in the center, with all the tribes very carefully and neatly placed around it. And there was nothing in the world that had been like that. And the efforts by Balak to get a curse pronounced upon Israel 3 times were thwarted. Numbers 24, verse 10. Then Balak became furious with Balaam, struck his hands together and said to him, I summoned you to put a curse on my enemies. Instead, you blessed them these 3 times. Now go to your home. I said I would reward you richly, but look, the Lord has denied you a reward. Before Balaam left, he did one thing. And that one thing we read of in our Revelation reading. And without the New Testament, I suppose we wouldn't know it. To the church at Pergamos, the Lord says, the Lord Jesus says, I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to throw a stumbling block in front of the sons of Israel, to eat meat, sacrifice to idols, to commit sexual immorality. And the outcome for Israel was catastrophic. While Israel was there, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. The women invited them to the sacrifices for their gods. The people ate and bowed in worship to their gods. So Israel yoked itself with Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that his burning anger may turn away from Israel. Balaam didn't get very far. In the war against the Midianites that followed, the entire tribal nation of the Midianites was wiped out, and Balaam with them. He certainly had his reward. Israel lost 24,000 lives. 23,000 of them in one day. Whilst they were still at that camp, in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, Moses spoke to all Israel everything that the Lord commanded him to say. And when he finished, it was right at the very end of his life, Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which faces Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land. And having seen the land, his life was taken away. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not weak, his vitality had not left him. The Israelites wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. and so did the 40 years. Joshua, son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands on him. So the Israelites obeyed him, and this is the Lord who commanded Moses. No prophet has arisen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. He was unparalleled for all the signs and wonders the Lord had sent him to do against the land of Egypt, for all the mighty acts of power and terrifying deeds that Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. And you have to wonder, brothers and sisters, how in the face of the hand of God, so visibly present throughout those 40 years, how people could fall away as they did. Just before he left them, in Deuteronomy 31, these are the words that Moses uttered. Verse 2, I am now 120 years old. I can no longer act as your leader. The Lord has told me, you will not cross this Jordan. And picture the scene, brothers and sisters. What Balaam had looked down on, that encampment of probably 2 million people, 600,000 men plus women and children, all neatly listening to what God had commanded Moses to say. That camp depicting the Almighty himself in their midst. Did they stand? Did they sit? We don't know. Did it go on for several days? Probably, because it's quite a lengthy book is the book of Deuteronomy, which they listened to. But what was evident was their separateness. And I think as Moses said that, you will not cross this Jordan. Moses knew why, because 9 months before, when he'd been commanded to speak to the rock, in his fury again, when he failed to keep the lid on his temper because of the murmuring of the children of Israel, he struck the rock twice. Hear now, ye rebels. And as he now, 9 months later, says to them that he cannot cross, I think the words would have been uttered very emotionally. They ate him out that he could not continue to complete the work. The Lord your God is the one who will cross ahead of you. He will destroy these nations before you, and you will drive them out. Joshua is the one who will cross ahead of you, as the Lord has said. The Almighty ahead of them, as he'd been in the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire. He will do the destroying. You will just drive them out. The work was as good as done. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, later Solomon writes in the Proverbs. He will direct your steps. And Joshua will be the man to do that. The Lord will deal with them as he did Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and their land when he destroyed them. You lay it waste. And they knew it to be true. It had happened just weeks before. The Lord will deliver them over to you, and you must do to them exactly as I have commanded you. Because the Lord himself has done the first part. He will hand them over before your face, and you must deal to them. In words that Moses had spoken just a little earlier, when the Lord your God delivers them over to you and you defeat them, you must completely destroy them. Make no treaty with them. Show them no mercy. They've made that mistake before in the camp. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters to your sons. Because they will turn your sons away from me to worship other gods. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you. And as we read this, the echo is how we are to deal to the sinful flesh that we inherit, that lurks within us, that tempts us, that lures us away, that teaches us in ourselves to do what Balaam taught them to do. And now Moses says, be strong, be courageous, don't be terrified or afraid of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you. He will not forsake you. And in those words, be strong, be courageous, we have two plural imperatives spoken. And an imperative is a command. It's not open to challenge. Physical strength? They didn't need that. It is the Lord your God who goes ahead of you. What they needed was faith. Based on all that they had witnessed God do to their enemies, to preserve and secure their salvation, could they not trust that he would continue to do it, having brought them thus far? And so do not be frightened. Do not tremble. Do not shake and quiver with terror from their faces. Why? Because the Lord your God will not desert you. He will not abandon you. And so now Joshua is summoned by Moses to come and stand with him in front of all Israel. And he said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong, be courageous. A repeat of the command, for you will go with this people into the land the Lord your God swore to give to their fathers. It was as good as done. God had spoken it, so it would come to pass. And verse 8, the Lord himself is the one going before thy face. He will be with thee. He will never desert thee. He will never give thee up. He will not forsake thee. And that, I think, is the reason for the imperative, the command. God can command it because of all that he has done. Some of us by nature are bold. Some of us are timid. But that's not part of the consideration. It's not us. It is the Father's good pleasure to give the kingdom. It's not them, and it's not us. The Lord said to Moses, "The time of your death is now approaching. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tent of meeting so that I may commission him." And then verse 16, chapter 31 says, "You, Moses, are about to rest with your fathers, and this people will soon commit adultery with the foreign gods of the land they are entering. They've already just done that, but they'll do it again. They will abandon me. They will break the covenant I've made with them. My anger will burn against them on that day. I will abandon them and hide my face from them so that they will become easy prey. Many troubles and afflictions will come to them." It was not that God was breaking his promise. It was that they would break the covenant enjoined upon them. And so the Lord commissioned Joshua. And out of that commissioning, again we have the words, "Be strong, be courageous, for you will bring the Israelites into the land I swore to them, and I will be with you." And Joshua heard that message direct with Moses at his side. And we turn over from the book of Deuteronomy to Joshua, and still in that same camp, after the death of Moses, God speaks to Joshua. "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you and all the people prepare to cross over the Jordan to the land I am giving the Israelites. I've given you every place where the sole of your foot treads, just as I promised Moses. The deed is done. I have given your territory." And then verse 5, "No one will be able to stand against you as long as you live." And this is why the instruction, the command, "Be strong, be courageous. I will be with you just as I was with Moses. I will not leave you. I will not forsake you." Again, "Be strong, be courageous, for you will distribute the land I swore to their fathers to give them. Above all, be strong and very courageous to carefully observe the whole instruction my servant Moses commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or the left, so that you will have success wherever you go. This book of instruction must not depart from your mouth. You are to recite it day and night so that you may carefully observe everything written in it. Then you will prosper. then you will succeed in whatever you do. Haven't I commanded you? Be strong, be courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. We cannot fail to get the emphasis that the Almighty puts upon it. You and I don't get to witness direct the voice of the Almighty as they did. The apostles did after the resurrection and the ascension of the Lord. And those who on whom they laid hands, as Moses had laid his hands on Joshua. I think this is where the exhortation comes in, brothers and sisters. The word exhortation is translated by the modern versions, encourage. It's a word of encouragement. And the word is that Greek word parakletos, a calling, kletos, and para, beside, alongside, a calling together. Like Joshua was called to the side of Moses. And as we think about it in the English, it means simply, doesn't it, to instill with courage. It's not about telling others what to do. We're in this together. It's a calling together. Something we all need. As Moses had said at the beginning of this Deuteronomy address, Joshua, son of Nun, who attends you, will enter the land. Encourage him, for he will enable Israel to inherit it. Your little children, whom you said would be plunder, this was the discouraging message. Your sons, who don't know good from evil, will enter there. I will give them the land. And again, it was an imperative. Encourage him. He will turn your discouragement into enablement. We have the word in a number of places, of course, in the New Testament. The word of encouragement, I mean. Remember Peter on the day of Pentecost, just a week out from the ascension of the Lord. He tells them what has happened and why they've listened to this display of multi-languages being spoken to present the gospel and call the people to listen. And with many words, Peter testified and strongly urged them, my translation says, but the word is this parakaleo again, it is to encourage them, be saved from this corrupt generation. And you see, he was speaking to a people who, for the first time, suddenly realized that they had slain the Almighty's Messiah. But what they now needed to do was to turn around, change their way. The situation was almost like it was in the plains of Moab after Israel had sinned so badly, they'd taken the bait of what Balaam had thrown them. In the letter to the Hebrews, we have a good example. Watch out, brothers, so that there won't be any of you an evil, unbelieving heart that departs from the living God. But encourage each other daily, what's still called today, so that none of you is hardened by sin's deception. And that's interesting, because this word strength that we've been considering, that Moses uttered, was to be strong, to be hard. Let none of you be hardened by sin's deception. For we have become companions of the Messiah, if we hold firmly unto the end the reality we had at the start. And the word comes again in chapter 10, verse 24. Let us be concerned about one another in order to promote love and good works, not staying away from our meetings, as some habitually do, but encouraging each other, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Well, I see time has gone, but we have the picture of the spiritual warrior in Ephesians chapter 6. Picture of a man girded with God's strength to go forth in faith. And there is the thought that without grappling, our faith can't grow. It needs exercising. We need situations to have to grapple with. We need to become like Abraham in his faith. And we look at that story of the life of Abraham, and it was the way he dealt with the problems that were strewn in his way that he grew. He did not waver in unbelief at the promise of God, but was strengthened, empowered in his faith, and gave glory to God, because he was fully persuaded that what God had promised, he is also able to perform. So what we read day by day has to be received into our innermost soul and transform our lives as it did Abraham's. Some of us have a pair of shoes with the word, or with the sign, Nike on the back. The word Nike is Greek, of course, and it simply means victory. Conquest, overcoming. And the last words of the Lord to the disciples before he crossed the Kidron Valley to go to the Mount of Olives to accomplish his final victory were, you will have suffering in this world. Be courageous. I have conquered the world. And the Apostle John, who heard those words of the Lord, later wrote in his first epistle, everyone having been begotten from God, born again from God, overcomes, Nike, the world. This is the victory of Nike, overcoming Nike, the world, our faith. Who is the one overcoming the world? Nike. Except the one believing, faithing, that Jesus is the Son of God. And previously, in the previous chapter, John has written, you are from God, little children. Just as the children of Israel were. And have conquered them. Nike. Because greater is the one in you than the one in the world. We read in Revelation 1, John's vision of the glorified Son of Man. And then in chapters 2 and 3, we have these letters to the seven churches, the seven ecclesias, the seven called together ones. And every one of those letters, personal to each ecclesia, yet read by them all, calls out, and every one of them has it, to the one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says. And then every one of them, of those seven, has a particular message to the one overcoming, a message of strong encouragement, a message of great reward.
Were the other ones coming out, or is it? Oh.